Good afternoon. I'm private counsel for Mr. Armellino. In this case, this is a case where Mr. Armellino went to trial with several victims on pattern counts of sex assault on a child. And he was acquitted of most of the charges and convicted of some of the charges regarding just one victim. But he was convicted of a pattern count, so he faced a mandatory DOC sentence. And the 35C issue, the issue one that I raised in the opening brief and the issue that I want to focus on in this oral argument is what happens in a situation post Lafler v. Cooper when trial counsel is ineffective for failing to enter into plea negotiations with the prosecutor and, in addition, is ineffective for failing to advise the defendant the maximum sentence he's facing, so the defendant isn't even able to make a knowing and intelligent decision whether he even wants to enter into plea negotiations. In this case, and the record is really uncontradicted on the point as to how Mr. Armellino was advised on the maximum sentence he was facing. Even his trial defense counsel agreed, and if you look at page in envelope 5, the exhibits to the Rule 35C hearing, in Mr. Bibick's interview with the district attorney, he admits that he didn't advise Mr. Armellino that the pattern counts carried a mandatory DOC prison sentence. What the district attorney asked him was about Mr. Armellino's statement that he, quote, would not go to prison. And undue focus was made on that statement throughout these proceedings. Mr. Bibick denies making that statement. But that could be interpreted several ways. What Mr. Armellino kept testifying to was my trial counsel kept telling me this case is a slam dunk. You don't need a plea because you're not going to be found guilty. That was trial counsel's assessment of the case.
Trial counsel denied saying that at the post-conviction hearing, didn't he?
What he denied saying was that he advised Mr. Armellino that he would not go to prison. Mr. Armellino is very adamant that his trial lawyer kept telling him this case is a slam dunk. Prosecution has a weak case. You're not going to prison. Mr. Bibick has a different opinion of that, but the key fact here, or I'm sorry, Mr. Bibick has a different memory of that particular fact. But what's important here is Mr. Bibick does corroborate Mr. Armellino's memory that he never advised Mr. Armellino that if he was convicted of some of these counts, in particular the pattern count, he was facing a mandatory DOC sentence. That is what's critical here.
Pardon me for interrupting, sure. Ms. Ruttenberg, if I may, please. Are there facts in the record that indicate that, at least from some witness, that Mr. Armellino did not want a plea disposition because he thought that he could beat the case?
Well, Mr. Armellino thought he could beat the case, and that was clearly Mr. Armellino's opinion. Mr. Armellino said that was based on his trial lawyer's assessment of the case. Mr. Bibick remembers things that not quite so black and white, but I think that's corroborated by all the witnesses that Mr. Armellino thought he was going to beat the case. But the record does not support the conclusion that Mr. Armellino would have never entered into plea negotiations, even if he had been properly advised that he was facing mandatory DOC time.
Well, we know now, after the fact, that that's certainly what Mr. Armellino says, but we really can't use this sort of looking backwards. What facts did we have at the time that he entered into the plea disposition to indicate that he would have entered into a plea deal if he had been given one?
Well, Your Honor, I believe you misspoke when you said at the time Mr. Armellino entered into the plea disposition, because he didn't enter into a plea disposition. There never was.
Oh, right. I'm sorry. I did misspeak. But what facts do we have that he would have entered into a plea disposition if one had been offered to him. And thank you for correcting me.
Yeah. All of these concerns, including what's in the pre-sentence investigation report where Mr. Armellino's bringing up again, my primary concern is my daughter. I wanted a resolution of this case so that I wouldn't be separated from my daughter. At the time, his daughter was a minor. She was struggling with the effects of a very nasty divorce. The daughter's now an adult, so it's a moot point. But at time of the trial, she was a child, and he wasn't allowed to see her. And that was his primary concern.
Counsel, I make sure I understood you. Did you say that he expressed his concern for his daughter in the pre-sentence report? Is that what you said?
Well, it's also in writing in the pre-sentence investigation report that he voiced those concerns. So that corroborates.
That would have been after he was convicted.
Exactly.
So why is that relevant?
Because that corroborates what he's saying now all these years after the fact, that his primary concern was his daughter, and that was his concerns he was voicing to Mr. Bibick and his trial counsel at the time. So it's not like he sat in his prison cell for the last 6 years and read case law and come up with, you know, all of these factors to support his position. You know, right after the trial, that's what he was saying, and that was in writing by a third neutral party, and that corroborates what he's saying now, what he was telling his lawyers at the time. So,
but it seems like, you know, it's not unreasonable for someone to have a different view about whether they should have taken a plea after the jury's convicted them. The question is really what they wanted before the jury came back with its verdict.
Your Honor, if you also look at some of these telephone calls that the district attorney entered into evidence, Mr. Armellino is discussing with other witnesses, such as Bob Gilbert, about plea negotiations. It's just not true that he never was willing to consider any plea negotiation at all. What he wanted, ideally, was a plea negotiation where he could keep his business. That's probably unrealistic, but he kept bringing it up. And those were in those phone records from pre-trial. And the district attorney entered those into evidence at the 35C hearing. And you can also look at Lafler v. Cooper itself. I think Lafler v. Cooper undercuts the Carmichael case significantly. In the Carmichael case, the Colorado Supreme Court said you have to have some sort of objective, something you can point to other than the defendant's self-serving statement all these years later that, well, had I been given a plea deal, I would have taken it. And the Lafler v. Cooper says, well, one of the objective factors you can look at is this great disparity in, and of course, in Lafler v. Cooper, there was a plea deal actually on the table, and I'll talk about how to distinguish that from this case in a minute. But in Lafler v. Cooper, there was this great disparity between what he was being offered, what the defendant in that case was being offered in the plea deal versus the sentence he got, and the court said that great disparity in the potential sentences can provide the objective evidence you need to show how the defendant was prejudiced from trial defense counsel's failure to properly engage in plea negotiations. And in this case, kind of the objective evidence you have now to support the second prong of Strickland, the prejudice analysis, is the fact that Mr. Armellino was facing a mandatory DOC sentence on the pattern count. He didn't know that. Nobody ever advised him of that. And Mr. Bibick agrees that, and Judge Munch actually made a finding that trial defense counsel never properly advised the defendant as to the fact that he was facing a mandatory DOC sentence. All of those are objective factors that, after Lafler v. Cooper, the courts can now use on the second prong of the Strickland test. And of course, in this case, we have the additional added problem that because of trial counsel's ineffectiveness in not kind of comprehending the fact that Mr. Armellino was facing a mandatory DOC sentence, never advised Mr. Armellino of that fact, and therefore Mr. Armellino didn't have the proper foundation upon which to make any type of knowing or intelligent decision, is the fact that trial defense counsel never entered into plea negotiations to begin with. So there's no plea offer on the table to look at. And that's, of course, another problem that the district court relied on in the analysis for the second prong of the Strickland test.
Ms. Ruttenberg, didn't Judge Munch conclude that there was no prejudice because Mr. Armolino was not interested in entering into a plea agreement at all?
And I argued at length in the opening brief, Your Honor, that the testimony at the 35C hearing did not support that finding, because it's not that Mr. Armolino never would have entered into a plea deal. It's just that he would have preferred, of course, initially, that he would have liked to have a plea deal that would have allowed him to keep his business, which have meant some sort of plea deal that would have avoided sex offender registration, which is pretty unrealistic. But Mr. Armolino never would have rejected a plea deal if he had understood that he was facing mandatory prison sentence. His goal was to stay united with his daughter. And the only way to do that would have been enter into some sort of plea deal where the prosecution drops the pattern count, which often happens in these type of cases, so that the defendant's probation eligible. That, because of the ineffective assistance of counsel in not properly advising Mr. Armolino of realistically what he was facing, that is why Mr. Armolino, rejected plea negotiations, because first of all, he thought he had a stronger case than he did, and second of all, he never realized he was facing mandatory DOC time. That is why that fact of Mr. Bibbitt admitting that he never properly advised Mr. Armolino of the mandatory prison sentence, does double duty here. Not only does it show how Mr. Bibbitt was ineffective, and it shows that the foundation under which Mr. Armolino was making his decisions was faulty, but that's also one of the objective factors now that the court can look at under Lafler v. Cooper under the second prong of the Strickland test, because now we have objective evidence regarding the disparity in sentences. I mean, Mr. Armolino thought that the worst case scenario, going into trial, worst case scenario, if he was convicted, that he would still be probation eligible, and that just wasn't true.
Why did he think that?
Because his lawyer never properly advised him that he was facing mandatory DOC time on the pattern count. And
so why would he presume he's going to be eligible for probation? I'm not sure where that comes from.
If somebody doesn't understand that they're facing mandatory DOC time, in other words, a mandatory minimum sentence if he's convicted under the pattern count as DOC, well then, of course, he thinks that he's got the full range of sentencing options in front of him. Not that he would get probation, but that he'd at least be probation eligible. And I mean, it's one or the other. If you're not facing mandatory DOC time, then by definition, you're probation eligible. And if you're probation eligible, then by definition, you're not facing a mandatory minimum DOC time if convicted.
Is the Rule 5 advisement from the very beginning of the case part of the record here?
I believe so, but I still believe that everybody is in agreement, including Judge Munch, and he made those findings, which are in his order, that Mr. Armolino was improperly advised as to the mandatory sentence he was facing.
By his attorney, right?
Right.
The court may have, and I don't know because I haven't looked to see, but the court may have, in the Rule 5 advisement, may have provided a proper advisement of what the potential penalties were.
And, Your Honor, while the Attorney General is doing his argument, before I get up for rebuttal, I'd like to reserve the last 90 seconds I have. I will check in the record and see if I can find that.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Majid Yazdi, registration 36043, representing the people in this case. The issue before the court is whether the district court properly analyzed and relied on facts supported in the record in denying the 35C motion. Looking at the order, it is clear that the court applied the proper legal standard by relying on Carmichael. And that Carmichael stands for the proposition that defendants' self-serving statements after the fact, after the trial, do not support the claim that he would have taken a plea offer if it had been made. And what is required...
Counsel, is that what Carmichael says, that it provides no support for that conclusion, or simply that it...
It's not sufficient.
...by itself is not sufficient, but it can support that conclusion?
Yes, it is part of the overall analysis. I meant to say that it's not sufficient by itself to establish.
Thanks.
What is required in addition to that is some objective corroborating evidence that the court took into consideration, and relying again on Carmichael, applied these principles and reached the conclusion that there is no corroborating evidence in this case. And actually there is evidence, corroborating evidence, that the defendant adamantly was opposed to any plea offers that would have included, of course, his requirement to register as a sex offender. He was adamantly against doing that because he was so much concerned about losing his professional license and his business. So, contrary to the assertion that his main concern was having a relationship with his daughter and supporting his daughter, the main concern, as expressed by defense counsel and conveyed to the district attorney who testified in the 35C hearing, the main concern was that he would not accept any offer that required him to register as a sex offender, because that would mean that he would lose his license.
May I ask this? If he doesn't know the severity of the potential sentence that he is looking at, how much can we rely on the statement that I don't want to enter into any deal that would make me lose my license?
From the record, Your Honor, it is clear that the defendant absolutely believed that he had not done anything wrong. He conveyed the same position to his colleagues in the email that I cite in my answer brief on page 14, that he says that he would not accept a plea for practicing what he had learned in workshops, etc. So, he firmly believed that what he did, and based on the tapes that he showed to the district attorney and the victim also saw, he believed that what he was doing was proper, and he could defend that. So, although it is theoretically possible that under some circumstances a defendant who faces a significant harsh sentence and long prison term may change his mind, here we have a defendant who has repeatedly stated, and this is how defense counsel also reached the conclusion, that there would be no plea bargaining if it is required for him to register as a sex offender, because he believed that there is nothing wrong with the treatment that he provided. So there is nothing in the record to indicate that the knowledge of the sentence would have changed that. The facts are based on the testimony by defense counsel that he would not simply take any offer because he did not believe that he was guilty.
Counsel, can I ask you a question about the trial court or the post-conviction court's finding that even if fully informed, the defendant would not have entered a guilty plea that would have caused him to lose his business and his license? Is that a factual finding to which we owe deference, or is that a legal conclusion?
I believe it is a factual finding because, again, based on the testimony presented to the court, the district attorney, defense counsel both said that this was what conveyed to them directly to defense counsel and indirectly to district attorney. So it is a fact that defendant was not interested in an offer that required registration. I think it's a factual finding by the court that needs deference by this court. In addition to that, The court also relied on the fact that even after trial, defendant continued to assert his innocence, even though this would have prolonged, this would prolong his sentence. And I think that is a very strong piece of evidence supporting the court's finding that this defendant firmly stood by his position that he was not guilty, even after trial, which answers to some extent the fact that even if he knew the sentence, he probably would not have changed his mind, because after trial, he knew the sentence. He is going through the sentencing and still denies what he did was sexual assault. And that is supporting, again, another evidence, piece of evidence supporting the court's finding that defendant would not have accepted an offer, even if it had been made by the district attorney. Lafler, by the way, does not change anything that Carmichael adopted as the proper analysis. And Lafler is clear that it deals with situations where an offer has been made. The court clearly states that if no plea offer is made, the issue raised here simply does not arise. So it doesn't change the fact that we still need objective corroborating evidence to support the fact that defendant would have accepted the plea offer. And there is no objective evidence here that the defendant was interested in any plea offer that the district attorney would have offered. And we also have the district attorney's testimony that it would not, the district attorney's office would not have offered any plea bargain that would not have included him registering as sex offender. So every piece of evidence, objective piece of evidence, refutes defendant's self-serving statement that he would have accepted a plea offer if he had been properly informed of the sentence by defense counsel. Unless the court has any question, we ask the court to affirm the court's decision denying the 35C motion.
Thank you, Mr. Yazdi.
Thank you.
Ms. Rettenberg, you've got a minute and 25 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Rule 5 advisement took place on January 13th, 2006. That hearing was never transcribed.
Fair enough. Thank you.
But there is a minute order in the record at page 379 of Volume 1. It's the felony minute orders. The court indicated that the pro se defendant was advised of his rights, the nature of his charges, and the mandatory protection order, but nothing about the mandatory sentence he was facing. And there's no other minute order in the record. I respectfully submit and bring to this court's attention that this case is very similar to the case United States versus Gordon, the Second Circuit case that our Supreme Court sided with approval in Carmichael. And in the Gordon case, there was also no plea offer actually extended, just like in this case. However, the court found ineffective assistance of counsel and ordered a new trial, and found that the fact that there was this great disparity between the actual maximum sentence exposure and the sentence exposure represented by the defendant's defense attorney provides sufficient objective evidence to establish a reasonable probability that the outcome of the proceedings would differ. Therefore, if this court follows the Gordon case, and it's very similar to this case on both the facts and the law, and as admitted to by Mr. Bebick, then you can find that there's sufficient objective evidence then to kind of overcome that presumption in Carmichael that the defendant is just making self-serving statements at his 35C hearing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Rettenberg. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your arguments very much. The case will stand submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course.